passes the U.S. House, Ukrainian soldiers say, you send it, we'll use it.
This aid will strengthen Ukraine.
TikTok gets a deadline, sell it or shut it down.
Both the Republican and Democratic parties and the Biden administration say TikTok poses national security risks.
And Monday is Earth Day. Scuba divers in Thailand are pitching in.
Beneath the waters of Thailand's Phuket, these divers untangle ghost gear caught on coral and trapping sea life.
Today is Monday, April 22nd, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman. After months of delay, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a $95 billion aid bill for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan. The measure now heads to the Senate, which is expected to take up a vote early this week. VOA's Arash Arabasadi gives us some details in this report.
Funding for Ukraine's war against invading Russia. Israel's war on Hamas in Palestinian territories. And support for Taiwan's military against a possible attack from China. The United States House of Representatives overwhelmingly voted to provide a total $95 billion in foreign aid this weekend in surprisingly bipartisan fashion for a Congress that's been bitterly divided along party lines. The vote was Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson's first major test leading his party's razor-thin majority.
I've said it very simply. I'll say it once again. It's an old military adage, but we would rather send bullets to the conflict overseas than our own boys, our troops. And I think this is an important moment, an important opportunity to make that decision. We allowed the House to do that, and I expect the Senate will make the same decision.
Johnson secured the necessary votes only by reaching across the aisle for help from House Democrats. Two hard right members of Johnson's conference threatened his ouster if he followed through with the Ukraine aid vote. Johnson's allies credit his fortitude in the face of rebellion. Republican Representative Michael McCaul, speaking Sunday on ABC's This Week, as provided by the social media platform X.
I am so proud of the Speaker Mike Johnson. He went through a transformation. At the end of the day, a profile in courage is putting the nation above yourself. And that's what he did. He said at the end of the day, I'm going to be on the right side of history, irrespective of my job. And I think that was what I admired so much.
One of the biggest sticking points for many Republicans was future funding for Ukraine. That country's leadership has been pleading with Western powers for material support in its war against invading Russia since the onset in February 2022. With the House passing its foreign aid package, Ukraine's president was quick to thank lawmakers and the American people.
This aid will strengthen Ukraine and send the Kremlin a powerful signal that it will not be the second Afghanistan. The United States will stay with Ukraine, will protect the Ukrainians, and they will protect, they'll protect democracy.
The bill contains $60 billion in aid for Kyiv now in its third year of war with Moscow. It includes $26 billion for Israel's war effort against Hamas, as well as humanitarian aid for civilians in conflict zones like Gaza. And another $8 billion for the Indo-Pacific region, where Taiwan continues readiness exercises should China invade. The legislation now moves to the Senate, where a vote should come early this week, advancing the measure to U.S. President Joe Biden's desk for his signature. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
While many people think this will get Ukraine back on track, some do not. Joining us now is Daniel L. Davis, a senior fellow and military expert at Defense Priorities, a think tank that advocates for a restrained and realistic foreign policy. Davis is a retired U.S. Army lieutenant colonel who served in four combat zones, including Iraq and Afghanistan. So the soldiers on the front in Ukraine are saying, if you make it, we'll use it. But how fast, assuming the Senate passes this right away, how fast can we get them stuff there?
It doesn't matter what they get or how much they're going to get. It's not going to change the course of the war. there's going to be, in my view, a great disappointment among all these people who were flag-waving cheerleaders on the floor of the House of Representatives and all their other supporters on television networks that have been saying how important this aid is, as though that was the difference between winning and losing. It's never been between that, and this will prove that, because the fundamentals that go between why Russia's winning and Ukraine's losing is exacerbated by the lack of shells and the interceptor missiles, but it's not because of those things.
Okay, so if it's not throwing munitions at Ukraine, what is it?
Whatever is going to be in this package, and that's still the big question I have, and I've been looking and I haven't seen it so far, of exactly how many shells this is going to purchase, how many air defense systems it's going to provide. I haven't seen any of those yet, but that's going to be critical to deciding how long it can even help, because that's the message you're going to get. So, for example, that there was allegedly an imbalance along the front line of up to, I forget the name, 1 to 5, 1 to 10 in disparity in both personnel and in artillery shells, depending on where on the front you're looking at right now. That's why they say they've needed this amount of ammunition. But here's the thing. Russia is producing somewhere, and I'm talking producing, coming off the assembly lines, around 250,000 shells per month. The West is producing cumulatively somewhere between 35 and 40,000 shells per month by the most recent estimates I could get. And that has nothing to do with this this supplemental. That's just as many as we can physically crank out. Now, what apparently this supplemental is going to allow is that as soon as the president signs it, he's going to send that number of shells from our existing inventory into Ukraine. So they don't have to wait till it gets produced. They're just going to get it. But that's the big question. How many shells are we talking about? Because then you have to take that number and then divide it by, you know, the front. And then let's just say that maybe you can change the ratio from 1 to 5 to 2 to 5 or 2 to 7. You're not going to redress that total change. And one of the bigger issues on the battlefield is Russia's accelerating electronic warfare capacity. So even though Ukraine has a lot of drones, 80% of them, by one count, are getting knocked out of the sky by electronic means. Russia's producing more of that, on the other hand, which aren't being knocked down at that pace. Russia has more missiles, and that's nothing's going to reverse those imbalances. And the biggest issue, the number one issue, is manpower. It's not about machines. It's not about ammo. It's not about money. It's about manpower. And Ukraine is on a death spiral. They're losing more people than they gain every month, and the people they're gaining are of very low quality because they've used up all the good stuff they have. Russia, on the other hand, is adding 30,000 to 40,000 troops per month signing up, so they are more motivated because they see they're winning. That's the big issue that I just want to pound home, that this supplemental is not going to change anything on the battlefield. It may expand the amount of time that Ukraine has, but ultimately, it won't change the outcome. It's just going to make loss more expensive.
One of the things along the lines of what you're talking about is Europe's ability to produce and send munitions and weapons as well. They talk about it, but it takes forever for anything to happen in Europe.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. That's one of the big issues. I think I saw, and this is nearly 2 months old now, but the projections were that by the end of the year that the West cumulatively would be able to produce somewhere around 1.2 to 1.3 million artillery shells per year, whereas Russia is going to be somewhere between 3 and 5 million per month on top of whatever they can get from North Korea, which apparently is quite sizable. But the West has a capacity problem. It doesn't matter how much money they have necessarily. It matters how many artillery shells they can physically produce. Even if money wasn't any issue, it's just that limited. And Russia's not that limited because their life and death is on the stake here. So their industry is completely sold out to this, whereas the West isn't. So it doesn't matter how much money you throw. It only matters how many shells the West can produce, and they can't produce enough to close the gap, much less overtake Russia.
Is there anything the West can do to turn this around?
There's not. It is irrevocable. And I know that's not popular. I know people don't want to hear that, but it's the hardcore truth. When you look at the fundamentals of combat power and how one side wins and how another side doesn't succeed, it's all irrevocable on Russia's side. And the longer this goes, the more months pass, the greater those advantages are going to be for Russia. The best thing the West and Ukraine could do is to seek a negotiated settlement now on the best terms available. I doubt that's going to happen because people don't want it. They're just not willing to look at reality, and instead they'll pretend the $60 billion is going to make a difference. They'll keep fighting, and they'll keep dying in larger numbers, but ultimately they'll probably lose more territory than they have right now, and they'll lose more men, and they'll get a worse deal later. That's the hard truth that nobody wants to look at.
Daniel Davis with the think tank Defense Priorities. At least five rockets were launched from the Iraqi town of Zumar toward a U.S. military base in northeastern Syria on Sunday. The attack against U.S. forces, the first since early February. Palestinians on Sunday recovered bodies found under rubble and dirt at Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip, weeks after Israeli army forces retreated from the medical complex. The Palestinian Civil Emergency Service said teams recovered 60 bodies from the hospital yards. That raises to 210 the number of bodies recovered since Friday. We're following these other stories from around the world. Hundreds of people marched through Niger's northern city of Agadez on Sunday, demanding the departure of U.S. troops from the military base there. An agreement had been reached the day before between Niger and Washington to begin the withdrawal. Kenya's chief of military, Francis Ogola, was buried Sunday. Hundreds of people attended the funeral, including President William Ruto, who paid tribute.
General Ogola was a consummate military officer, a passionate commander, and a patriotic citizen of Kenya.
Ogola was among 10 soldiers killed when their helicopter crashed in western Kenya shortly after taking off on Thursday. Ecuadorians have voted in a referendum touted by the country's fledgling leader to crack down on criminal gangs behind a spiraling wave of violence. The majority of 11 questions posed to voters Sunday focused on tightening security measures. Proposals include deploying the military in the fight against the gangs. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, the trial of former President Donald Trump enters a new phase Monday when opening remarks begin. VOA's Veronica Balderas Iglesias says on Tuesday, U.S. President Joe Biden will make a campaign stop in Tampa, Florida, talking about reproductive rights.
Now that 12 jurors have been selected, prosecutors and Donald Trump's defense team will make opening statements Monday in the criminal hush money trial against the former U.S. president in Manhattan, New York. He faces 34 felony counts for his alleged role in trying to hide hush money payments to women who claim to have had extramarital affairs with him before the 2016 presidential election. Trump, who is also the presumptive Republican presidential nominee for this year's general election, has been adamant in denying the charges.
This is a giant witch hunt to try and hurt a campaign that's beating the worst president in history. Biden's the worst president in the history of our country, beating him by a lot. And this is the only way they think they can win, but it's not going to work.
Bad weather conditions forced Trump to cancel a weekend rally in North Carolina. On Saturday, he took to his Truth Social platform to argue why he should be granted presidential immunity in a separate federal election interference case. Oral arguments will be heard by the Supreme Court on April 25th in that case. Some Democratic voters watching closely could become energized, analysts say. George Washington University professor Todd Belt via Skype.
As for voters watching this, has less to do with Donald Trump supporters because many of them do have an authoritarian streak and many of them would like him to be able to do whatever he can as president. Biden has made the case that you can't put somebody back into office who's a real threat to democracy to do anything they want.
U.S. President Joe Biden, who is running for re-election, continues to abstain from mentioning his rival's legal challenges. On Friday, he directed his political messaging to the International Brotherhood of Electrical Workers in D.C.
My predecessor rolled back protection for American workers. He opposed increases in federal minimum wage, and he was proud, very proud of his $2 trillion tax cut when he was president that overwhelmingly benefited the wealthy and created the biggest corporations and exploded the federal debt.
Union workers are increasingly one of the swing groups that both presidential candidates need to win over, says Associate Professor of Government at Georgetown University, Hans Noel. He spoke to VOA via Skype.
The Democratic Party is the party that's been, you know, supporting your causes in the past. It's a thing that they need to be reminded of if Biden wants their votes. Meanwhile, Trump is also going after that same demographic with a slightly different message, a message about immigration, about culture.
Trump must attend his criminal hush money trial in person this coming week. The next campaign rally, as advertised on his campaign website, won't be until May 11 in Wildwood, New Jersey. Biden's campaign told VOA that the president will give remarks in Tampa, Florida on Tuesday, focusing on the high-stakes issue of the 2024 election, reproductive freedom across the country. Veronica Valderas Iglesias, VOA News, Washington.
As part of that vote for aid for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan in the U.S. House of Representatives, there was also a bill that would ban TikTok if its Chinese owner, ByteDance, did not sell its stake within a year. On Sunday, TikTok said again it feared the bill would trample the free speech of 170 million Americans. Here's Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen.
The bill is passed without objection. A motion to reconsider is laid on the table.
The House approved the legislation 360 to 58, which was a part of a broader foreign aid package. The Senate is expected to vote on it this week, and President Joe Biden has said he would sign it into law. Many U.S. lawmakers from both the Republican and Democratic parties and the Biden administration say TikTok poses national security risks because China could compel the company to share the data of its 170 million U.S. users. TikTok insists it has never shared U.S. data and never would. Democratic U.S. Senator Mark Warner, chairman of the Senate Intelligence Committee, on Sunday told CBS News TikTok could be used as a propaganda tool by the Chinese government. While Democratic U.S. Representative Ro Khanna told ABC News Sunday that a TikTok ban may not survive legal scrutiny in courts, citing the U.S. Constitution's free speech protections.
Reuters correspondent Alex Cohen. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman. Nearly 15,000 homes have been flooded in the Russian region bordering Kazakhstan. More now from Associated Press correspondent Karen Chalmers.
Nearly 14,500 homes have been flooded in a Russian region bordering Kazakhstan after water levels spiked in a local river. In the Kurgan and Tuymen areas of Russia, drone footage from Russian TV showed vast areas of houses submerged in water to their roofs. Russian authorities said some 20,000 people had been evacuated between the two areas. Rescue crews attempted to stop further flooding by throwing sandbags along the riverbank. In Russia's Orenburg region, thousands of people were also evacuated following the collapse of a dam on the Ural River last week. Experts cited multiple possible causes of the floods. They say large snow reserves in the area have been melting. I'm Karen Chamas.
Heavy rain struck major rivers, waterways, and reservoirs in China's Guangdong province Sunday, triggering floods and a landslide that forced the government to enact emergency response plans to protect more than 127 million people. And finally, Monday is Earth Day. In Thailand, scuba divers have been working to remove abandoned fishing gear from coral reefs. Reuters correspondent Ilan Rubin says the work is setting the stage for a global effort to save reefs from what they call ghost gear.
Beneath the waters of Thailand's Phuket, these divers untangle ghost gear caught on coral and trapping sea life. The lost or discarded fishing equipment is considered one of the deadliest forms of marine plastic waste. Off the Phuket shore, divers are equipped with submersible gear, scissors, nets and notebooks. They are recording data on their cleanup mission. Natchanon Kyatkajornphan is a marine scientist.
Firstly, we will record where we found it, the date, the depth in meters, what type of fishing gear, and what type of surface the gear is on.
About 1 million tons of ghost gear ends up in the ocean each year, according to the World Wildlife Fund. It breaks down into microplastics, which are consumed by marine animals and can end up in the seafood humans eat. Experts say the lack of a coordinated strategy is standing in the way of more comprehensive and effective solutions to track, manage or outlaw dumping of fishing equipment. Salisa Trapipitsarat is a senior campaigner at the Environmental Justice Foundation.
There's no uniform data collection.
The data collected by divers is used to determine the extent of ghost gear and its environmental impact.
Once we have this data, various organizations can take the raw data and see if we should first address the plastic pollution, whether through policy, legislation, or management.
Reuters correspondent Ilan Rubin. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for spending this time with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. You can also download the VOA app. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The United States renews its call on Libyan political leaders to commit to participate in the UN-facilitated talks, said Ambassador Robert Wood, U.S. Alternative Representative for Special Political Affairs at the United Nations.
We continue to believe that a political agreement is crucial to unlocking a viable process towards long-overdue elections, and we firmly support UNSMIL's efforts to find creative ways to get the main power brokers to the table.
We reiterate that those who continue to delay the process hold a heavy share of the blame as yet more time passes without the election of a legitimate unified government, stressed Ambassador Wood. On the economic front, increasing instability, evidenced by the recent drop in the value of the Libyan dinar, continues to fuel the country's deepening political divisions. To ensure the provision of essential services to the Libyan people and an equitable distribution of revenues, it is important that Libya produce a unified budget and take steps to stabilize the currency, said Ambassador Wood. Progress toward military unification is key to reaffirming Libyan sovereignty and preventing Libya from becoming enmeshed in regional conflict, said Ambassador Wood.
We are closely monitoring the situation in Niger, Chad, Sudan, and Mali, including the movement of foreign fighters and rampant arms trafficking, and its destabilizing implications for Libya.
In February, the Security Council called for the withdrawal of all foreign forces, foreign fighters, and mercenaries from Libya, noted Ambassador Wood.
We remain particularly concerned by the activities of the Russia-backed Wagner Group, a transnational criminal organization with no regard for Libya's sovereignty or that of its neighbors. We extend that concern to efforts to consolidate Wagner personnel into Russia's Africa Corps.
Turning to sanctions, Ambassador Wood expressed concern about the increase in violations of the arms embargo and illicit oil export embargo, which has necessitated a greater number of interdictions by Operation Irini, an EU naval effort to monitor and disrupt illicit activities off the coast of Libya. we encourage other member states to support and inform efforts to implement the arms and oil embargoes, said Ambassador Wood. Violators are complicit in the deteriorating political, security, and humanitarian situation in Libya. The United States remains committed to using sanctions to deter threats to peace and stability in Libya.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.